Hey, Mike.
Hi, Caleb. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. It sounds like you're not doing so well still.
No, I'm still on the mend. This has been a very persistent illness, and I thought I was better, and then I wasn't. We had a little bit of a false summit problem, and yeah, it's been really irritating.
So, have you seen a doctor?
I have. Okay. I'm on antibiotics. Well, I just finished. Might need some more. I don't know. We'll see. Yeah, it's just irritating.
Are you having some orange juice or water tonight?
Tonight, I am drinking a lemon lime Gatorade.
Oh,
yes, I'm staying hydrated and replenishing my electrolytes because it's got what plants crave, I guess. how about you? What are you drinking?
Well, I'm not drinking anything from Idiocracy, but I am having some French Sauvignon Blanc. So just a simple finishing off some white wine from the weekend.
All right, then.
Yeah, nothing super fancy tonight, but it's good. It was, a little bit nicer than the two-buck chuck that I usually get, so can't complain. So tonight I thought we could talk about cruise.
Cruise.
Yes, not the High Seas Adventures or anything like that, but...
the movie star?
Nope, not Tom Cruise. The autonomous vehicle software and hardware company Cruise, primarily because we've had them in our on our show list for a long time, and they recently did a big round of press because they did an investor day, and they also did press rides for like 10 or 15 different publications here in San Francisco. And so,
like, mainstream stuff, not like automotive press or anything. This was,
yeah,
like
whole wide
Wired and Wall Street Journal and New York Times.
Yep, TechCrunch, Reuters, and then some of the automotive press, and then investors as well. And so this is really the first time they've let outsiders go into their vehicles. So I thought it'd be useful to go through sort of a deep dive on the company and history and sort of what their approach is. And they shared a lot of new information that hadn't come out about how the company works and their point of view on things. So it should be a fun discussion. So
cool.
So to start off, sort of one of the things that GM, let's go back. So Cruise is now owned by GM, just so that we have that out there, but I'll get to how that happened. So how did Cruise get started? Two guys started it. It was originally started by Kyle Vogt. And Kyle actually has a lot of background in self-driving cars and robotics. He was actually had built like a prototype when he was a teenager of a self-driving car in his garage.
Well, who hasn't?
Of course. He then went to MIT and he was there in 2004 and actually participated in the DARPA Grand Challenge the first year.
Wait, he built a self-driving car before 2004?
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm not sure the full scope of the capabilities, but he was working. He had been interested in robotics for a long time, and so he went to MIT to study robotics. While he was at MIT, he did the Grand Challenge with them, and then he also had an internship with iRobot, the makers of Roomba, the vacuum cleaner robot for your home. Cool. And he also competed in two seasons of BattleBots, which
awesome.
Was a fun show.
Yeah, yes. I love BattleBots.
So
Did he win?
He didn't. I don't think he won. No, yeah. I don't think he won, but he did compete in two seasons. So
was the robot autonomous? Because usually they're controlled.
Yeah, I think it was controlled. Yeah. And I actually know Kyle personally. So full disclosure, I'm not an investor in the company or anything, but I do know Kyle because he was also one of the co-founders at Justin.tv. And so the live streaming company. And so when it was just Justin and Emmett, they were looking for someone to help them build the live streaming rig itself. And they put out a call to the MIT listserv and Kyle answered the call and they flew him out and he impressed the heck out of him. And so he built this backpack that Justin would wear that sort of multiplexed these LTE cards that were pretty new or 3G cards and
Feel like you might need to, for younger listeners, you might need to actually go deep on what exactly Justin TV is.
Oh, yeah. So this fellow, Justin Kahn, decided to live stream his life. So he wore a camera on his hat, a video camera.
And this is like pre-iPhone and everything, right? So this is not like you couldn't just like Periscope or do any sort of Facebook Live stuff. This was well before any of that.
Yeah, like 2005, 2006 era. Yeah, something like that, 2005, 2006. And yeah, so they built their own custom live streaming backpack. It was a heavy backpack, and he would wear it all around San Francisco and got a lot of attention for this. And it sort of was sort of this interesting, weird project, and got some Y Combinator funding. And then they turned it into a place where other people could broadcast. And so they had some other live streamers. And then they turned it into like a full on, anyone could broadcast from their webcam. And so Kyle was there from that whole time and was one of the founders. And so I came into the picture to help out on the product side a few years in after they had already started going, and they had, you know, tens of millions of unique visitors already. So I think the team was maybe 15 people or so when I joined, maybe 12 or so. And so I met Kyle and he was sort of in charge of product and the technical, a big side of like the back end streaming side of things. So he was sort of still responsible for the core infrastructure for the site.
And then we should also point out they eventually became Twitch, right? Didn't they?
Yes. Yes. So,
and did he leave before the transition into Twitch or did
after he slightly, so, slightly so, after.
Okay. So yeah, he was involved with that as well.
Yeah. And then he was also involved in the Social Cam, which was another spinoff from Justin TV to do a live streaming for iPhone as a separate app. And that company was acquired for $60 million or so. And then Twitch has been acquired for about $1 billion from Amazon. And then Cruise, as we alluded to at the top, was acquired by GM for somewhere around $1 billion. It always is difficult to pin down based on how the cash and stock and retention and all that works out, but
yeah, they don't a lot of money with those announcements.
No, a lot of money. Yes. And so what, like, he started Cruise and it wasn't what it is now. So he started it, and apparently, you know, for the first 3 months it was just him, and Y Combinator is about a 3 month program. It's like an accelerator program where they invest and they have a few months in the summer or winter, and then they have a demo day where they show off what they've done. And so Kyle got this prototype working of basically a highway autopilot, like the very first version of Tesla's autopilot, where it would work with Audi A4s and S4s. You'd mount it to the roof of your car, and the car would drive down the highway, specifically the 101 here in Northern California. And so that's their very first prototype, was this way to, you know, soup up a A4, and they were going to charge $10,000 for it. And they had like 50 people who would reserve them and all this stuff. And then they, you know, got a few people to join, another co-founder, Justin Kahn's brother, actually Daniel Kahn. But when they went to go raise Series A, they had decided to can that product and stop working on this partial autonomy, partly because it was going to be really difficult to sell an aftermarket hardware product, both for regulatory reasons and also just hard to really get integrated. And you'd have to do a lot of work to make it work with all the cars and all these things. And ultimately, Kyle sort of realized that the big opportunity here was to go to full self-driving. And why not just focus on that hard problem right away?
I didn't realize that they were doing that. They started out doing that, because that's essentially what Comma AI is yes. doing, right? Yeah, it's yeah. kind of the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, they had originally envisioned Cruise of having sort of a, you know, the sensor be this external thing you'd put on the top of the car, where Comma is focused on just using, at least today, just the cell phone cameras. I think eventually they'll have some other hardware, but yeah, kind of similar. So they started doing this prototype of within a few months of sort of a full self-driving, and so in, you know, about a 7-8 months in, they had like a very, very rough demo. And so they raised about $13 million on that sort of prototype to go build out this full self-driving. And they sort of stayed quiet after that, because they had done some press for this early product, but they sort of went quiet after they decided to pivot and start working on the full self-driving. And then they started meeting with GM, and GM heard that they were working on this. And so the GM team was actually really smart and started, you know, going for rides in the prototype and sort of benchmarking their progress. And one of the important things with any new technology is certainly to understand what the improvement rate is. And so they actually got not just one slice of, okay, well, how good are you guys now? They were tracking them for a little while. And GM ultimately decided that they were making such rapid progress, and they felt like they were the sort of the strongest opportunity out there. And so they actually decided to buy the company. And when they bought them, they were just around 40 people. So it was still very, very small, relatively, for the ambition. And so Cruise was acquired.
For the acquisition price, too.
That's... Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And so I think either right after that or right before that, Amazon had bought Twitch. So Kyle is co-founder of two companies, just around $1 billion. So definitely good stuff there. And, you know, from personal experience, Kyle is incredibly smart and capable and talented. And so when I heard the news, I was like, this is a great deal for GM, because he's excellent. And even during the Justin TV days, we all knew that he was into robots, and it was sort of funny that he was doing software when he knew and we all knew he wanted to be doing robot stuff. So it was just sort of personally cool to see him actually working on doing the self-driving car thing. So one of the things when he sort of described why they ended up selling to GM was that they realized that doing the car part in part of their experience building the sensors for aftermarket was going to be very difficult. And even if they could get the software perfect, they didn't feel like they would be able to necessarily have a good way to get to the market without a car, and that the car companies would certainly have more resources to invest in this and an existential risk not to invest in it. And so I'm quoting here, he said, "We sucked up our pride and did what was right for the mission by selling." And certainly the price doesn't hurt, but you know, a lot of startups don't want to sell when they're only, you know, a couple years old. So they did, and they've already quadrupled the team size since GM's bought it. So it's definitely gotten a lot of investment, and they were acquired in March of 2016. So as we record, that's 20 months. So they've made a lot of progress, which we'll get into in a minute.
Yeah, they actually were right. I worked right around the corner from their office, and I would see there before they got acquired by GM, they were using a Nissan Leaf or multiple Nissan Leafs with these giant like metal rigs on them with all the stuff. And I would see it come out of this rundown little house in an alley with like a garage in it. It looked more like a home than an office, like in downtown San Francisco. And yeah, they would just occasionally come out of the alley, and I was like, what's that car? What, that car's got a lot of kit strapped to it. What's going on?
Yeah. Cause at that point, no one else was really testing in San Francisco. Right. And yeah, they had two Nissan Leafs, he had said. And,
I think it was the only other thing around is down in Mountain View, you would see the Google vehicles, but that was it.
Yeah. So they were 46 people when they were acquired. And then a year later, they had 150 people. So 3x in 1 year, and the number of test vehicles went from two Nissan Leafs to 50 Chevy Bolts with a B, Bravo. And now they're up to 150 Bolts with a B, Bravo, and they're up to 1,200 employees. Now, wow. 400 of those are full-time in San Francisco. So a large percent of those are temporary, and also so like people who do the driving for them temporarily and mapping and maintaining the vehicles. And then also some of the GM employees who are part of the Cruise team, but don't work in the San Francisco office. But they're bigger than Waymo right now from a total employee count, just for context for folks who are listening. So they've shown some progress videos along the way, and I think this was the way most people sort of heard about them or found out about them over the past year before they've really gotten any of this recent press. Do you remember watching those videos when they came out?
Yeah, they had, I think it was this summer, right? They had the videos of them driving. They had like a 2 or 3 minute drive through San Francisco. Well, like a longer drive, but it was like sped
40,
up.
To 40 minutes or something, I think most of them were.
Yeah, and it was showing all of like, you know, car recognition, people putting the bounding boxes around things, and kind of, it was just cool to watch. It was kind of watching like, it was one of these like POV things where you're kind of seeing what the car is seeing, basically.
Yeah, and they also had one where it was at night as well, and so like
that was the one with the night. With the raccoon that ran out, right?
Yeah.
Stopped for the raccoon.
Yeah, it stopped for a little raccoon, and you know, this is testing in downtown San Francisco, and I think, as we'll talk about, that's a strategically important thing for them. And certainly when I saw these videos, it was quite impressive to see so much driving in San Francisco, and having personally driven in San Francisco, it is not as complex as New York City or Boston, but it is not easy or stress-free. And I think it definitely has a very high percentage of pedestrians and cyclists who do not behave in necessarily consistent manner. So it's a lot of erratic cyclists.
It's not a city that's like a strictly laid out on a grid either. You've got a lot of kind of organically grown streets, and you have a lot of hills, and you have a lot of weird angled like driveways and alleys, and it is a pretty challenging and of course like pretty bad roads too, so you have some potholes and other stuff to deal with. So yeah, it seems like a good challenge.
Yeah, so those videos came out and people were like, oh, this is cool, but again, it's just like a cherry-picked demo video. And so even though there weren't any disengagements where the safety driver had to take over, people were like, well, how good are these really?
I think this was after Tesla released their driving from Los Altos to Palo Alto video, right? Mm-hmm. Or around mm-hmm. the same time. So there was already some precedent for it. And, you know, there wasn't much action after Tesla released theirs either. So it's like, you know, how much of this is just, you know, a dog and pony show?
Right, exactly. And so the only hard data we had up until now was the February 2017 disengagement report that had come out before these videos. And so this is the companies that are testing self-driving vehicles in California have to report every time a human backup driver has to take over. And they have to report sort of why and the number of miles they drive autonomously, which then gives you a way to calculate a very gross understanding of how much progress each manufacturer or, you know, startup is making towards not having a human need to intervene. Now, the caveat here, obviously, is that why you might, you know, engage or disengage rather can vary. And also where you're testing in the state will have a very big impact on why you would need to disengage. And also, you only have to report for public road miles. So you could be testing on a private track or private land and not have to report disengagement. So with that, Cruise out of like 11 companies had the second highest number of miles in the year. So in 2016, of just under 10,000 miles driven autonomously. The number one was quite a bit more at Waymo with 635,000 miles. So
that's a big delta.
Yeah, it's like 1.5 orders of magnitude. So quite a lot more miles for Waymo. And so Cruise had 181 disengagements in that time. So that's a rate of 18.5 disengagements per 1,000 miles, which is like, okay, well, 1,000 miles, you know, you have to take over 20 times or so. Okay, that, you know, that's not good enough yet, but it's okay. But then when you compare that to Waymo, Waymo in that same 635,000 miles had 124 disengagements, which works out to 0.2 disengagements per 1,000 miles. So around 19 per mile per 1,000 miles for Cruise and 0.2 for Waymo. So if you hear that, you're like, oh, they're clearly Waymo is way better. And so then you dig in and you look at the sort of disengagements per month, and you look, if you chart that on a graph, you sort of saw that in the beginning, they were not doing very well in the beginning of the year. And then once they
Cruise.
Yeah, and Cruise, and sort of then in the August, September, October, November of 2016, they started having exponential improvements in their how long they could go without a disengagement. And so we are pretty soon, in about a couple, in maybe 2 months, going to get the new update for 2017. And certainly they've been driving a lot more miles in 2017. So they did around 10,000 miles last year. And this year, Kyle's already said publicly that the cars they've been doing have been doing hundreds of thousands of miles. And by next year, they want to be doing 1 million miles a month. So pretty soon, they're going to be quite a bit past what, you know, far beyond what they've done in the previous year, and they believe they're on track to beat Waymo in terms of disengagements for this upcoming year. So it'll be interesting to see how those shake out. The important thing is, from their point of view, is that they're testing in cities and dense cities. And so even though their disengagements might be worse, they feel like we want to deploy inside of cities, and cities show more unique events. And they've actually released some data around this. So if you look at like Phoenix, where they also test and where Waymo has been testing, you can see like, okay, left turns in San Francisco per 1,000 miles, they had to do 1,400 left turns. And in Phoenix, they had to do 900. So 1.6 to 1, not that big a difference. But if you look at things like navigating around construction, it's a 40 to 1 ratio in favor of San Francisco, and encountering emergency vehicles is like 50 to 1. And construction blocking a lane is 20 to 1. And doing a left, like a lane change, is like 5 to 1. So their point here is that, yes, they do test in Phoenix as well, but San Francisco has a lot more of these unique events and rare events and challenging events. And they want to basically make as many interesting things happen for every mile they're driving, so they have more data to feed into their systems and more to evaluate for their engineers. Because if you're doing miles that you're succeeding at all the time, that doesn't necessarily provide much insight for improvement. It can help prove statistical safety, but it's not helping you improve the system as much. So, right. Do you have any take on sort of this? Do you buy that argument of testing in cities is harder and maybe more useful? Or
I mean, you're training something, right? You want it to learn all of the different things that can happen, and so you want to actually expose the system to as many like variables and different scenarios as possible. And you know, having the same 50-mile commute on a highway, you know, day after day doesn't really do you much, because once you've learned how to do it, you don't have as many anomalous events on the highway. You know, you'll have some, but when you're talking about like density of experience or something, it's like kind of, you want to, it's like cramming for an exam or something, right? You don't want to just keep reading the same paragraph over and over again. You need to, you know, go for the breadth first approach, and, or, you know, go for a wider approach. And yeah, that totally seems like it makes sense.
Yeah. And so that's, so why do they want to be testing in San Francisco and in cities? And one of the important things for GM, as they think about, well, why does GM want Cruise? And you step back and you're like, okay, they want not to sell autonomous vehicles. They want to sell access for transportation. And so they outline this pretty convincingly. And basically they, at this investor event, basically said, okay, if you break it down, there's around 3 trillion with a T miles driven per year in the US. So 3 trillion miles. And right now, even as hyped up and excited and as big of a shift as ride sharing and sort of the Uber and Lyft and et al. Have brought on to the US, it's 0.1% of miles. So if you believe that ride sharing hasn't yet fully penetrated the market, you have a lot of opportunity in terms of miles that people drive to transition from the way it's done today to a new model. And so they see that as a really big opportunity. And the challenge for why ride sharing can't go that much bigger in its current world is that the cost per mile for ride sharing, even in its current sort of permutations, limits the number of miles it's useful for. And so their sort of GM's assessment is that, you know, current ride sharing is good for around 0.5% to 1% of miles, which is worth about $20 billion in total value. But if you could get the price per mile down from sort of $3 per mile, which is sort of what it costs now, to around $1 per mile, you'd be able to 150x the number of miles that would be available or useful for that type of a service. So you go from 1% of miles to 20% of miles if you can get the cost down.
Yeah. And, well, you got to cut out the human driver, right? That's the...
Yeah, that's a big one. And then the if you can get it down to below a dollar, you get to 300 times where you're at today. So you get to around 75% of miles. So if you can get a AV system that could drive anywhere, now that's the one big challenge. But if you could do it under a mile, the economically rational thing to do would be to transition your costs from the way you're buying miles today by buying a car, leasing a car, trucking, all these things. You would transition to an autonomous vehicle. And so GM's point of view is if they own the service that you use, you will be paying that money to them. And instead of paying it to all the various services that go into that, what is it, $1.6 trillion spent to do that today, that would go to GM. So yeah, that's why they care about this and why, in their view, they want to start with cities. Is there's a lot of miles done in cities, and they're currently very expensive miles because of ride sharing. And it's very expensive to own a vehicle in a city. And so the competition for price is a little bit easier because it's already more expensive to get a mile in a city than it is to get a mile in the center of the United States. And then also, interestingly, they pointed out was GM does really well with trucks, like pickup trucks and large SUVs, and they don't sell many of those in the cities. So they're not really concerned about cannibalization, where in rural America and sort of the suburbs, where they do sell those vehicles, they don't expect ride sharing or their autonomous vehicles will necessarily have a huge impact right away. And so by that point, their ride sharing market will already be bigger than their regular car market, potentially. So I just thought that was sort of interesting that they were concerned a little bit about cannibalization, and focusing on cities is an area GM currently doesn't have a lot of penetration in. So it's actually additive to their business, which I think a lot of people wouldn't have considered off the bat.
Yeah, it also seems like they, a big company like GM is also dealing with a lot of car financing. I knew they used to have like, or maybe they still do have like GMAC. GMAC.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they, you know, they do leases, they do loans. And so technically until those are paid off, they do own a lot of vehicles already. So even though they are selling cars, they in, you know, if you kind of blur it a little bit, they are technically owning a lot of these cars for a while, at least through some series of financial instruments. So it's, you know, because that would be one of the differences, is that they would now own all these fleets of cars. But, you know, it's not that different than having a lease where you're spending $200 a month and then you just like give the car back at the end, right? Like GM still owned that car.
Yeah, exactly. They had to find the financing for it either through their own cash or through lenders, which they have a really big facility to do that. So,
right. Which is just, I mean, I guess, which I should have specified to contrast it with something like Uber, where one of their big you know, value things that they base their business on is that they don't have inventory. Like other people bring their cars to it. So that's kind of something that would really change for Uber, but technically wouldn't really be all that different at a 30,000 foot level for GM.
Yeah. And one of the questions during the investor event that came up that was sort of interesting was someone asked, so what's the lifetime value of your sedans today compared to the lifetime value you expect from these autonomous vehicles that you'll be running, you know, in the near term? And one of the GM execs said, well, right now, you know, we average around $30,000 per vehicle over the lifetime, depending on the financing and all that. But we expect the lifetime revenue on an AV will be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, even pretty early on in the cost curve, like within the first few years of this technology coming out. Wow. So from their point of view, for that same car, hundreds of thousands of dollars of revenue per vehicle. So
I guess that makes sense when you think of most cars are idle 95% of the time. And I mean, maybe if you strike out half of that for the fact that most people are asleep around the same hours, you still have 45% of the time. So you can kind of, 9x the current. So that would be, well, you know, 30 times 9, 270. I don't know. I'm doing some back of the envelope stuff real time here. That's never a good idea, but
also
it seems to make sense.
Yeah. And also the lifetime of the vehicle will be longer. They're going to be building them to go longer. And one big thing, which you've been talking about throughout the entire time we've been doing the show, is GM is committed that all of their autonomous vehicles will also be fully electric vehicles.
Excellent.
And so they see that as both part of their mission to how do they get to a zero emissions future. That if millions and millions of miles are driven in these cities, they will be electric.
And I wonder how that will bring down their fleet average if they can still sell even bigger gas-guzzling SUVs and trucks to the rest of the country if they have even more fleet vehicles running electric in the cities.
That's interesting. I'm not sure. I don't know how the how it account. I guess they would have to sell it to a subsidiary of themselves, but that would probably count, I guess, if. Anyways, that's a good one to follow up on. So I think that's just like great news. And one big reason as well, just practically, is that the EVs are less maintenance, and so they will last longer. And so they believe they'll be able to have these vehicles last a lot longer, and the drivetrains will last longer. And as the battery chemistries get better and better, the actual costs of the vehicle will go down below internal combustion engine vehicles as well. So
I imagine it would be all of the interior and contact points that would have to be cycled out a lot more rapidly than drivetrains in these like shared vehicles.
Yeah. One of the things they also talked about was how they're building up the infrastructure to sort of service the vehicles. And one of the things they were saying is they think they can increase the useful life of the vehicle 3 to 4 times by this moving to like aircraft maintenance style. It's called repair overhaul, maintenance repair and overhaul model. And so basically, yeah, they're going to make it so they swap out the seats and they can swap out other parts of the car much more like you would an aircraft than you would a personally owned vehicle, where everything just sort of degrades and then you hit 150,000 miles or something. And
oh man, does this mean they're going to get to the point where they've managed to move the seats around so they fit like 8 seats into a Bolt? That's what an airline would do. I'll have my knees in my chin and I won't be able to fold down my tray. There's 8 people in the Bolt.
Yeah, they said that they don't expect to change the configuration of the cars for quite a while. That even at launch, they believe they were going to be better by about 40% discount than a traditional rideshare company. So
right, we'll have to make sure they keep some healthy competition in there so we don't kind of get a Delta situation.
Yeah, so I guess one of the sort of important things is they want to launch, so we sort of touched on it, but just to reiterate, so they want to launch in cities because there's the ability to compete with ride sharing. There is a lot of expensive miles being done there, so they believe there's, if you can offer a cheaper product, there will be a lot of demand to use these vehicles. And because it is not yet possible to sort of make these cars go cross country or anywhere you want, that if you geofence them, you locate them in a particular city, you can, you know, scope it to San Francisco and New York City and these cities. And it's actually not that much roadway when you consider the total amount of roadway in the world, or the US in this particular case. And so it's actually sort of a tractable problem to map these individual cities and still have a lot of usage. And then also because they are cities, the trips are sort of short and there's a higher density of people. So to the point you made earlier of sort of utilization, it's much more feasible to imagine how you would have these cars utilized more than if you would in a suburb where you drop someone off and then you have to drive 5 miles to go pick someone else up. And people aren't necessarily moving around as much during the middle of the day, where in a city, you just have much more dynamism in how people are, you know, moving around throughout the day. So a lot of good reasons why they're focusing on the city, and for a business point of view, and then also from a technology point of view, it also makes sense. So it's just both of those align really well. They're not sort of fighting each other, which I think is kind of special in this case.
Cool.
So I guess the next big thing to talk about is so they decided to do some press rides, and so they let members of the press get in some of the Bolts, and they took them for about a 20-minute ride around San Francisco. So they have their app. The app is like Uber or Lyft. It shows their Bolts driving around, and they have employees at Cruise who are using this now as sort of dog fooding, like beta testing it. And Kyle said in the past publicly that there are some Cruise employees who use it as their only form of transportation now. They don't use the bus, they don't use Uber, they don't use Lyft, they don't use their own personal car because it runs 24/7. And so they let some of the press do these rides and write about their rides. And so
I think that they had like three destinations they could go to, if I remember correctly from reading these reviews. So they it was a little bit constrained, but
they had some pre-chosen options. But even if you were to say drive on these roads inside San Francisco, they didn't have them like cordoned off with police or anything. Like these were active live roads without escorts or anything. So
they seemed like they were pretty spread out. Like it wasn't just like, you know, three places on an easy route. They seemed more kind of to give you a good sense of driving around San Francisco. So it didn't seem like it was cheating at all. It seemed more representative.
Yeah. And they, I mean, they went through Potrero Hill, which has some extremely, as in the name, hilly areas. And you come across some of these hills and you crest and you really can't see anything. And you're on a really steep grade and there's bicyclists going by. And then in Soma area, there's like a lot more pedestrians wandering around than would seem normal in most cities. And so, it was definitely kind of an intense area. And, you know, when we read through most of the reporters' takes, and it looked like the majority of them did not have to have any intervention by the safety driver. So they still had a safety driver behind the wheel to ensure safety. They haven't pulled the safety driver out, where Waymo has in Chandler, Arizona, which is a big deal. But Cruise hasn't yet. They will, but they haven't yet. And it seems like most people were actually, the big theme for me at least was people being surprised at how cautious the vehicles were and how safe they were. And then also as a result of that, currently how jerky and not necessarily smooth they were. And Kyle, during the presentation, had mentioned that smoothness, he sort of laid this out as like a hierarchy of needs for the AV. And at the base of the pyramid, the most important and biggest part is safety. And so that's where they spend the majority of their time. And the second most important part is getting you to where you want to go. So being in the car and not moving isn't very useful, even if it's safe. And so he said, like, we've spent like 90%+ of our energy on those first two parts. And rider comfort is higher up on that list. Rider entertainment, the user experience of getting into the car and all these things, like adjusting the AC and all that. They haven't spent time on that yet because those are both easier problems and problems that come later on after you've solved these base parts of the pyramid.
Yeah.
So he called that out very explicitly, but it definitely came through in many of the articles that people, as much as it might be safe, it didn't feel like a human yet.
If it did, it was kind of somewhere between an overly cautious to somewhat neurotic human driver.
Right. And I think that's actually a really interesting point, that even if that's a relatively simple thing, it is going to be very important for people who are riding in these vehicles to feel smooth, and that safety is both a reality of statistics of not getting into accidents and such, but also a feeling of safety.
Right.
And part of that is communicated through the smoothness. And
yeah, also, if you're ever in a car with someone who's driving aggressively or hitting the brakes a lot, you naturally tend to start grabbing the door handle or the handle above your head, because all of that makes you feel like you're in a dangerous situation, even if you're not.
Right, exactly. And so you just sort of start paying more attention, getting more freaked out, and just sort of start sweating, and it's just not a comfortable experience. And so, you know, good chauffeurs are very good at driving smoothly and, mildly, not super, super cautious that they slam on the brakes as soon as it turns yellow, but know how to use judgment there. So
yeah. I mean, even if it's being super conservative too, as long as it's being smooth, if you're not driving, it's probably good, right? Because you're just going to be on your phone or on your computer or drinking coffee or whatever. So you don't necessarily care that it took you an extra couple of minutes to get to your destination, but you do care if it's spilling your coffee or if you can't keep your laptop on your lap or that sort of thing.
Yeah. And I think that, I do believe that will come, and certainly the controls aspect of that is, you know, you can imagine that is how that is a smaller amount of work than the entire scope of creating a self-driving vehicle stack.
Yeah, it makes sense. And it's funny how it seems to parallel how humans learn to drive too, right? Like when you first get your license, you're super cautious, you're hitting the brakes, and then eventually you start to settle in and become, you know, slightly more sophisticated, and you're able to, you know, kind of do a little more advanced planning and know when to start slowing down or when you can, like, you know, assert yourself. And yeah, I just was kind of struck by the human parallels there.
The only one that did, I was curious your take on, from an engineering point of view, was just sort of this idea that part of the issue with being smooth would be having more foresight into the future. So if like my refresh rate on my eyes was like one frame per second, then I would probably be more jerky. If I noticed something like a pedestrian, I would have to slam on the brakes because I just saw it and like I don't have much distance to brake.
Right.
But if I had perfect vision and could see a mile down the road, I could know in advance that I'm going to need to brake or, you know, all these different things. So it does seem that part of the problem or challenge is going to be, how do you make it safe? And if you see someone starting to walk out into the sidewalk or from the sidewalk into the crosswalk, that if you're close, you don't want to slam on your brakes, but you might want to for safety. And so it's going to be an interesting contention for being an abundantly safe driver and not, you know, doing some of these things. Cause you have to be better than most human drivers. So I was curious if you had any take on like, if the sensing piece probably could be the limiting factor, or if you think it's just curious if you had any thoughts.
I think, well, I mean, you're getting into like predictions, and I think that they touched on that in, I believe, the article in Wired, in their test drive, where I think at one point it noticed a woman with a stroller on the sidewalk who was walking towards the street.
Mm-hmm.
And they mentioned that they are getting better at kind of predicting a few steps ahead at what will happen. And like, they noticed that human was like moving towards the street, and it out of caution stopped. And it kind of like, it was in an awkward place in the intersection, but it stopped because it thought that human might go. And I think it brings up a couple of points. Like you say, you start getting into this idea of like, it's not just a matter of sensing everything at some point in time in the environment, but you're sensing things with trajectories, right? So you're getting into like modeling, like, okay, so this person's walking here. And if you know it's a person on foot, you can kind of say, well, they're only going to be moving maybe like, what, 3 miles an hour or something. But if it's a bike, it could be going faster. So like getting into like recognizing those sort of things and predicting, you know, there's also like, you know, if a car is coming at you, you know, they probably can only stop so fast. So you have to learn, you know, if it's, you know, it's not going to be able to stop. And if you can, you should. And I think there's that whole thing, which kind of makes sense that, you know, it might not be as sophisticated with that yet. And it sounds like it's something that they're working on. And that will get better over time as it gathers more of these experiences and can better predict what's going to happen in its environment, as opposed to just what is currently in its environment. And then I think the another part of that is this idea of one of the things that goes missing with self-driving vehicles, where there's no human in the passenger seat, is you'd miss a human to human interaction, where like if you're standing on a sidewalk, I'm like 99.9% pedestrian. So I'm more accustomed to being on the pedestrian side, and I won't step out in front of a vehicle if the driver is not looking at me, if they don't see me, right? Like even if I have the crosswalk, I want to make sure that they are actually going to stop and that they see me. And I think there's a whole interesting signaling aspect of this, where self-driving cars might need to be, I mean, it could be something where there's like, you know, a display of like, you know, showing that it's okay to cross, or that it sees you and like internally on the screens, it's showing the passengers the environment that it notices and where it sees cars and people or something. But maybe that's something where you also need to kind of reassure the people on the exterior that you see them because there's no eye contact to be made. I think that's probably a whole discipline of design that's going to be opened up there, and probably something where, you know, at first, if they're just retrofitting vehicles, it's probably just going to be cautious and maybe like start rolling forward to signal that you're going to go. But over time, we might end up with more sophisticated bi-directional communication between, like, you know, pedestrian and autonomous vehicle.
Yeah, I mean, literally today, I saw interacted with one of the Starship robots, the delivery robots on the sidewalks, and it was trying to cross an intersection in Palo Alto. And we were driving and we didn't really know if it was going to cross or if we should go or what, because it was about to enter the intersection, but there were a bunch of cars at the intersection and no one really knew what to do because it was sort of acting like a pedestrian where it was going to cross, but it didn't. And obviously you don't want to hit this like robot thing crossing the street. So it was definitely a strange thing and it wasn't doing anything. It was just totally stationary. So we couldn't, at like to your earlier point, make any sort of adjustment to like what the trajectory of this thing was. So it was an interesting challenge because we didn't know what to do. And ultimately we just went because we're like, well, it's probably just going to wait for us to go because it wants to protect itself. But
yeah, it wasn't giving you any sort of affordance as to what it was thinking. And I guess that also brings up to, I was just talking about like car to pedestrian, but you also have a lot of interactions between vehicle to vehicle, like flashing your lights or honking your horn or just waving your hands or giving the nod. There's a whole bunch of stuff that is going to kind of go away or at least need to be sort of retrofitted to kind of train people how to interact with cars that don't have someone sitting in the driver's seat.
So some of the other things that Kyle talked about that I wanted to point out just from the technical side of things, because we've talked about many of the different subsystems that go into these autonomous vehicles in different episodes. And so a lot of them were described. So I think it's kind of interesting to hear how Cruise is approaching these different components. So he talked about the, and I'm looking at a slide here of the self-driving software brain, the deep simulation capabilities, their HD mapping, their proprietary sensors, the redundant systems, the automotive safety work they're doing, the cybersecurity and electrical architecture, which I know you're very interested in, and then some of the vehicle connectivity and data collection. So they highlighted a lot of like these 15 different subsystems that they're working on. But one thing they pointed out as well is that they're working on all of these in parallel. So they're working on both the software side at Cruise, they're working on the hardware suite and the Bolt, like the vehicle work with Cruise and the GM corporate team and vehicle development team, as well as the city planning teams for deployments all in parallel. And they're all driving towards, which I didn't mention at the top, but I probably should have, now a new announced 2019 launch for fully self-driving in major cities, most likely starting in San Francisco and also most likely in New York City and Manhattan in 2019, early 2019, first quarter. So
yeah, Cruise was the one where they made that announcement and then apparently they had only cleared it with New York State and not New York City. So that there might be still some politics to play there.
I think so. Yeah. They said they wanted to start mapping New York and doing some testing there, but yeah, the mayor did not seem like he was briefed, even though the governor was cooperating. So it will come to those cities as well. But 2019, like that's a year and a few months away from when they want to launch, and that would be without human drivers. That would just be fully autonomous.
Oh man, you're finally gonna maybe get your Model 3, and you're gonna have this option, and you won't even need a car.
I know that's the big thing we got to talk about at the end. But in the one thing that we've talked about a lot is the this idea of the sort of deep learning versus a more programmed, heuristic based, rule based system, and the dichotomy there. And Kyle sort of talked about their pretty pragmatic about this, and basically their general principle is that as they've designed new parts of the system, from mapping to sign detection to lane detection to pedestrian detection, any of these systems, they have typically started with a more traditional heuristic based, rule based intuition of the person coding it up to get something working, And then as that subsystem becomes more stressed and becomes more of a bottleneck, or is the part or the root cause of challenges on the road, they need to improve the efficiency of it or the capability of it, they move to making a deep learning model or implementing a neural network or some other machine learning technique that's more sophisticated but requires a lot more data. And so they've done this apparently dozens of times for multiple subsystems of the sensing and planning and localization and mapping parts of the vehicle. And so I think their broad message was there's no silver bullet in actually sort of the production engineering of making these vehicles, the software for these vehicles, that you can't just feed in steering data and pedal data and out comes a self-driving car, that it is a useful tool when you want to improve the capabilities of some system and get beyond, you know, 90% detection of lights and signs and pedestrians, and you need to get to 99 point some percentage. But when you're first starting out as a part of the system, it might be overkill. And I sort of thought it was nice to hear a more pragmatic sensibility on that from someone who's actually building this, when a lot of the research papers and things would have you believe that, oh yeah, you know, one algorithm to rule them all will solve self-driving, and if only we had more computing power.
Yes, this, you're getting into the difference between theoretical and applied engineering.
Yes, and Kyle is definitely in the applied engineering mindset. Not to diminish his intellectual capability, but he is about solving problems for real and writing the code to get them done. And I'm sure he's not writing nearly as much code as he was in the early days, but he is not someone you could bullshit on what your approach is. So
Has Cruise done any announcements about any sort of simulation work that they've been doing, or have they been mostly focused on actually getting the cars out there and getting real world data?
Yeah, so they did talk about that in this presentation as well. And so they have three different types of simulators. One is focused on the driving experience of the cars and replaying difficult corner case events they had, as well as safety critical events that they run all the new software through. They also had one sort of for simulating the sensor readings for the vehicles to make sure that the simulated sensors were reporting back useful information. And then there was another simulator that they didn't describe in a lot of detail. But he said they always had up to 150 virtual cars running through the scenarios at all the time. So 24/7. And it looks like they're using some sort of game engine. From the screenshots, it really looks like Unity or something like that. So it's like a high fidelity game. It looks like GTA 4. one of the important things they said was, they run up to 500 different scenarios before any code that's being, you know, tested can go onto any of the cars. And then they, you know, deploy it to a few cars, make sure it's working, and then they deploy them to all the rest of the fleet. They're doing simulation sort of like unit tests, like we were talking about why simulation is so great, sort of continuous integration, but with simulation.
Cool. So one other question I had too is, and I didn't see any of this here. Maybe you did. So currently I imagine they're just using stock Chevy Bolts, Bravo Bolts, with obviously retrofitted or augmented with all of their sensing equipment. But do they have, as they go into putting these out into the world, is it their intention that they will be able to just take Chevy Bolts and add sensors, Chevy Bolts as they come off the production line and add their sensor package and have it go? Or is there going to be any sort of like redundancies put into the system? Will it have like just the standard braking package, or is it going to have like redundant brakes, redundant steering, redundant everything, as for getting into more like an airplane kind of mode, or is it going to just be a stock thing with a artificial driver?
Yeah, so they've done a lot of work on this area, and they spent a lot of time talking about this in the audio part of the presentation. They started with this. They call it Gen 1, which is they took the Bolt and they bolted on their sensors. So they took a stock bolt, like the day they arrived at Cruise, in GM, like the, you know, as soon as bolts were available and Cruise was part of GM, they just started bolting their sensor suite and moved from their Nissan Leafs. So no core changes to the vehicle. The second generation version, they worked with the engineers, the production engineers at GM, to rebuild some of the systems and basically move to automotive grade components for all of the sensor and interconnects that they had been just sort of bolting on from like electronics supply world. And so they moved to automotive versions of those. And then they also started modifying code on many of the systems and the controllers inside the vehicle that interface with the sensors, so that they were more aware that they weren't just being hacked, but they were actually expecting these sensors. So they could more cleanly interface with those sensors in the vehicles. And then they also built some sensors from scratch and also some of the controllers in this generation too. And that's what the majority of the vehicles, if you've ever seen like a Cruise test vehicle, most of those are Gen 2s, and also what the press rode in. And they now have a Generation 3, which should be coming out in the next couple months. And in September, they announced it was complete, September of 2017. And the important thing is they believe this is the first production vehicle that is capable of full self-driving at scale. So it has the redundancy needed, so redundant steering, redundant braking, redundant power, basically has the full capability to fail and do that operationally and safely. And they pointed out that 40% of the parts in this Generation 3 Bolt are different than in the production Bolt that ships to consumers.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, it's a lot of different pieces. It will be mass produced, so that's the other thing. But it is designed to be produced at their Orion, Michigan facility. So while it's not the same vehicle that's going to be coming off the line, you can sort of think of it as if they had like a really specialized high-end premium version of the car where it's like got different trim levels.
Yeah, or like when they do the Crown Vic, but they soup it up for police or taxis.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's still built in the factory and is built by GM standards and tested and has all the sort of quality assurance you would have for the vehicles, and can be built in a factory environment. But it is, not exactly the same vehicle for obvious reasons. And they also pointed out that the vehicles now have 40 sensors in total, and 21 of them are radar. So wow. It was kind of crazy because if you look at it, they have five LiDAR on the top. And so those are not cheap. Then they have 14 cameras.
Is it spinning LiDAR or is it solid state?
So they're not solid state yet, but they're not the spinning. So they oscillate within their own field of view, but they're not like the big spinning ones. So they're not 360 degree. So they have five that do get them a 360 degree coverage.
Okay, so it sounds like they're banking on getting to the solid states when they're available.
Well, they've actually bought a company. They acquired a company a couple months ago called Strobe, and they build solid state LiDAR. So they've acquired them to do it in-house and accelerate their production schedules so that they can get the cost down from $20,000 to $300. Acquisition. Yeah, so they think it's going to have like about a 99% drop in price. So back to the sensor suite, because obviously Tesla has a sensor suite that they believe is fully self-driving capable, with 8 cameras and 10 ultrasonics and 1 radar. And Cruise has the 5 LiDAR, the 14 cameras. They have 3 articulating radar. I haven't seen this before. So they have radar on the mirrors that actually can move, so it can help see around parked cars and, if there's sort of an obstruction or a truck, if you need to see around a truck that's double parked, I thought that was really interesting. That they've
weird.
Got,
so it's like a bug with antenna coming out of it?
Well, yeah, like it just sort of, it can rotate a little bit to get a better picture. And then it has 8 radar in the front for long range. And then it has 10 ultra short range radar, which might just be ultrasonic, but they said radar. So they might be, you know, more sensitive than parking sensors for really close range. So it has a lot of sensors on it. Certainly more modalities and more coverage than the Teslas have. And
lot more data coming through to process as well.
Yeah, so right now they said they're processing 200 megabytes per second per vehicle, which works out to 2 petabytes per week of exhaust data. So a lot of data. And so there's also a massive amount of compute and storage on the vehicles as well. And they have around 180 of these built so far.
Have they talked about who's doing are they using the NVIDIA stuff or are they doing something else?
They didn't mention who's doing the compute, so they haven't described that. They didn't talk a ton about that. But one of the reasons, obviously, they can handle so many more sensors is one, they're like actively trying to develop this right now, and obviously have some success, right? Like they had reporters and it worked. So part of it is in the future. You could imagine a world where you could make this work with a camera because humans can do that. But to help expedite the process and not have to have 100% or a much larger percentage of the work rely on the software, you can use the hardware to help with the perception and not have to, you know, spend as much time intuiting, you know, the perception side. So they're doing that to help speed the process. And they're not selling this to a consumer. They're going to amortize the cost of these sensors across all of the rides. And in the beginning, they really just need to break even on the rides. And if they do that, then they could deploy tons and tons of these vehicles in a city at break even. And then they'll start to be able to get the economies of scale of the sensors. And the primary expensive sensor is LiDAR, which currently is very expensive because there's not many of them made in the world. And so, you know, they will eventually, given their plans, get the costs down, but they don't really have an intention of selling this vehicle like you go walk into a Chevy dealer and buy one. So the sensor cost is similar to like an aircraft where, yeah, you care about the price, but it matters how much that incremental price can get you more customers over the lifetime of the vehicle. So that's right. What they worry about is how much is the sensors and how quickly are the sensors evolving such that they become obsolete before they've paid back. But you know, they can do that math themselves.
So you mentioned that, you know, it's not in something that you're going out and buying, but GM is selling like the Cruise or something, Super Cruise or whatever in their Cadillacs. Like how does that?
That's a totally different team and system.
Okay. So that's not just this stuff being ported over. Okay. It's more like just kind of auto or assisted driving or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. From the best of my knowledge, that team is totally separate, working on their own track for the semi-autonomous stuff for all of their production vehicles. And the Cruise team is focused on their fully self-driving software, pretty much exclusively. Now there are other people inside GM who are helping get the Cruise vehicles out the door, but to the best of my knowledge, Cruise is not helping with the semi-autonomous features for Cadillac and folks like that.
Okay. It's a little confusing that they called it Super Cruise.
Yeah, it is. And they also are doing HD maps. They use mapping vehicles to map the cities and get the super high resolution, like we had talked about, of, you know, the super, you know, 3-centimeter accuracy, LiDAR scans, humans and automated processing and labeling. And then it takes them about 6 months to build the map for a city, which is sort of the first time we've heard how long that actually takes. So it's a meaningful amount of time. Like it's not just like drive around the city for a couple of days and you've got it mapped. 6 months is a lot to make sure you get every inch of the city, but it's not years. You can imagine how, you know, you could get all the major, you know, the top 50 cities in the world if you had a couple dozen mapping vehicles in each city.
Yeah, I wonder how much that done. How much of that can parallelize too? Like, you know, is it like it takes 6 months with the N vehicles they have. Can they, like, you know, have like 5N vehicles and get it done in, like, you know, just over a month?
Yeah, they didn't. They didn't say how much more that could come down, but they didn't talk about that as sort of one of the big pull items that they're working to improve. Because the other factor is once they have that map, they did say that once they get around 1,000 vehicles in a city, it will fully update on its own because the cars driving around also contribute to the map, mm-hmm. and that within within a few minutes, anything on the map would be updated.
So it's just more of a bootstrapping thing to get a new,
to get it started. And then once they have density of actual vehicles driving around, the maps will be self-healing. And he said also that Kyle again said on the call that they originally were looking for a mapping partner, but they couldn't find anyone they thought was doing a good enough job. And so they decided to build the technology in-house, both for the map format they were going to use, the actual mapping capabilities of the collection, a lot of the tooling around the annotation and labeling, and then also the updates and distribution back to the vehicles live, because they also, you know, download software via the 3G and LTE connections to the cars to update them. And so all of that is owned by them. So
I wonder how much of that utilizes Mechanical Turk on the back end to put humans in the loop for identifying all this stuff.
This would just be a guess, but of those 600 or so employees who are temporary, I would bet a lot of those are labelers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Part-time labelers. I guess one of the sort of the other pieces I sort of found intriguing was that they already are talking about how they're going to roll out in more cities and how this is like already like there's a very you get the sense listening to them that there's a very real and discrete plan of events that's going to happen to make this roll out for real, from like the charging infrastructure, the cleaning infrastructure, the mapping of the different cities, making sure they have the legal like right of way to do this, that they have all these, like they've already done three generations of the vehicle. They'll probably have another generation of the vehicle before they actually fully launch. They've got 400 people at the headquarters right now working on the software side. They plan to double or triple that in the next year. That this is like a very real thing. This isn't 10 people coming out on stage for 10 minutes at the auto show showing off some crazy new concept. This is a very real project by very serious people dedicated to this. And I think it'd be hard for anyone to claim this is vaporware at this point. So I think that's very impressive. And I think it makes me more concerned for Tesla's ability to launch fully self-driving in anywhere near this time horizon. And
because there's too much to do?
Because there's so much to do. And that Cruise has already been testing in San Francisco for about 2 years, and they are where they are, and they're not ready to let regular people use it. They think it needs at least another full year, and maybe it'll take more, but at least another full year. And they have a team completely dedicated just to self-driving. And that team is larger than Tesla's team. And Tesla is trying to do this at a much larger scale in cars that are already shipping with the sensor suite that is not as robust and is they don't have full redundancy in all the major systems of the vehicle. And so even if you believe, so basically it's like, how much is the head start of the learning rate? How much work has Cruise done that Tesla will be able to leapfrog and basically not have to do, or has already been solved and is like free to adopt essentially from a work point of view? Or how much of everything that Cruise has done is actually the same work Tesla has to go through? And I just don't know how you get around solving and testing for all these edge cases that every single day they're working around. Like, how do you get around a taco truck? How do you deal with a double parked car in this place? How do you deal with a double parked car on this side? How do you deal with a pedestrian approaching at this speed? Like, all these crazy things they're seeing. that we haven't seen a Tesla self-driving vehicle testing anywhere.
Yeah. Do you think it sounds more like Tesla is just going to be more of a constant disengagement sort of thing because it's a personal vehicle and it's not a service like this, that Tesla just thinks it's going to be more acceptable to, when you get stuck behind the taco truck, you just disengage and let the person do it?
Yeah, I do. Because if you look at even what Cruise's capabilities were like a year and a half ago, when they'd only been doing it for maybe a year and a half, they were still like up to, you could go 400 miles per disengagement on average. So that's still a long time without having to touch the wheel at all. Right. Yeah,
especially for city miles. That's
yeah. For city miles, that's
like a month or more of driving.
Right. So in that case, if you know there's going to be a human driver behind the wheel, that still is a pretty magical experience.
Yeah.
And so that was what their performance was last year. And that was still orders of magnitude worse than Waymo. So if you are really shooting for not having a human and you're trying to get there as fast as possible, then you need to do sort of what Cruise and Waymo are doing with crazy sensors and like more, not hacks, but like more willing to solve the edge cases however you need to get them done. Where I think Tesla might be taking this sort of more erudite like approach of, we're going to try and solve it from a more purely like, what is the more optimal engineer, like more optimal computer science approach of this vision neural network, and just rely on cameras, because if humans can do it, god damn it, we should be able to do it too.
Well, yeah, approach. And even then it's not even necessarily more computer science-y, or it's just more human focused, right? It's more anthropomorphic. Yeah. Where you're maybe, you know, having a human isn't the best way to do it, but for Tesla, if they're going to be selling the vehicle to people as personal vehicles, it has to be human focused anyways. Whereas the companies like Cruise or Waymo, they can just kind of reduce or eliminate some of these assumptions and maybe get a better system by not making it more human-like.
Yeah, and obviously, yeah, Tesla is selling these vehicles. They haven't mentioned any plans to want to sell or make a vehicle that they're not going to sell to consumers that is going to have self-driving, right? Like they haven't talked about that at all. But the weird confounding thing is they have talked about this fleet idea where you would, you know, rent out your vehicle for when it is capable of full self-driving. And so that makes me believe they think that they will get there in a near enough term, but they are still so far from that being possible. And then Elon Musk was saying in the past week that he thinks they're 2 years away from full self-driving and 3 years from 10 times better than a human. And unfortunately, 2 years ago, he said he thought they were 2 years away. So it's a little bit like Charlie Brown and Lucy with the football kind of situation. And it's a little bit, in the arc of time, they will get there, right? Like the capabilities of publishing a website on the internet now are available to millions of people, where 100 years ago, no one had that capability, right? So
yeah.
It will eventually diffuse to everyone. It's just, in what time horizon? And to your earlier point, I think it is possible that some people may be driving in a passenger in a self-driving Bolt in San Francisco from Cruise before they get delivery of their Model 3 in, you know, Australia maybe, or New Zealand. Like that's possible. And that is a really, obviously you can be like, well, Cruise isn't available everywhere, but as more and more people are living in cities, and if you do live in that city, like you have access to a full self-driving car, like that's a big, big change.
Yeah.
And
it seems like with the backing of a huge company like GM and having proving it out in a congested, difficult city like San Francisco, it seems like their kind of go-to-market plan for expanding around the country is pretty straightforward, right?
Like yeah, exactly.
If you're going to cities, you're not just some little startup and you're not like some company with just a crazy idea, right? You have a proven technology and the backing of one of the big auto manufacturers in the US. So it's going to be hard to say no to that.
And yeah, like if you've solved the harder part of the problem of a city, like San Francisco. And then their next city they want to do is New York City, Manhattan. I think that's probably the one that people would be one of the most like freaked out about and try and defer as long as possible on, because they don't want to push their technology or risk that it's not going to work.
Right. And, well, so, and you're going up against like all of the drivers in New York as well, whereas other cities might not have as much of a labor force there.
So they're going for the hard thing, because if you can make it, when you can make it work there, all the other top nine cities are not as challenging, maybe Boston. But other than that, like there are some regional differences, but the core will have been solved. And then certainly suburban is like he mentioned on the call, like they don't even test in Western San Francisco, which is like the Richmond and the Sunset. Like they literally do not test there because it's too easy. And yeah, those miles aren't useful. So they've blocked those off from being hailed for employees, and they don't test there. So,
and for listeners who aren't familiar with San Francisco, that's like the outer parts of San Francisco that go into just a really, really repetitive grid pattern, yeah, of like low rise housing.
Yeah. And it is very easy to drive out there, and there's not much going on, and it's just not nearly as dynamic as down by, you know, Union Square and whatnot. So there's that. And then there's the other piece, which is if this is a network effect type experience and there are gains to be had for a long time in the actual quality of the technology. So if you believe that both there is a big learning curve and there is a big amount of upside still to be got in the technology, then if they are one of whoever is first to deploy this at some meaningful scale, hundreds or thousands of vehicles in cities, then they will take a lot of market share from the existing ride sharing. So they'll get a lot of customers because the cost will be 40 to 50% cheaper. Like, and we've already seen as Uber and Lyft fight over incremental pennies on rides that will move people between which, you know, each service. So people are already super, super price conscious. So I think on the demand side, they're going to have plenty of demand for people who want to ride in a vehicle that's cheaper and they don't have to ride with anyone else and they don't have to deal with a driver who they don't want to talk to or listen to bad music or whatever. And then they're going to get more and more miles and keep improving. And so if you can't compete with both the same price and the same quality experience as evidenced by, you know, how good your software is, I don't know how you'd catch up. And that's what Cruise and why they're pushing so hard and why Kyle personally is so invested in making this happen as fast as possible is he believes very deeply that this is going to be a lot like Google search, where yes, Bing and others eventually created search that was pretty good, but it wasn't as good. And so it doesn't get to beat others in the same way.
Yep.
And it's really hard to catch up in some of these markets where you have both network effects and differentiated user experience. So if you believe that's the case, and I'm more and more believing that is the case for, you know, ride sharing in some of these markets, then yeah, I mean, personal car ownership in cities is probably going to be one of the quick ones to go away, because, you know, if you're just using it in the city, it's going to be way more costly than using Cruise or Waymo or something like that. So I think this is very real. It's coming very quickly. Cruise, if you have not been paying attention to Cruise, I would definitely start paying more attention. Listen to some of the things Kyle said, and I think you will get a very clear understanding that this is really real. And if you're excited about what Tesla's doing, it's not the same thing. They're not doing the same thing right now, and that's okay. But if you want to drive in a self-driving car, I think it's more likely it'll be Cruise than Tesla first.
On a completely selfish note, did they mention how when they plan to expand from San Francisco down into Silicon Valley?
They did not.
Ah, okay.
I know.
Hopefully that will be a part of the initial suburban push.
Yeah, I know they have done some testing on highways, so, but yeah, it's definitely different going at higher speeds. So in the cities they only go max 20 miles an hour because the speed limits in the city is 25 miles an hour. So slower speeds both are safer, so if you do get into an accident there's less risk of fatal for the driver, at least. Certainly for pedestrians and cyclists it's still a very big risk. But for the passengers of the vehicle, it's lower. And also, from a perception point of view, to our earlier point, if you're going slower, you have more time to react, and you don't need to see as far. So I do think there's some differences for highway speeds, which Waymo has been addressing, and, you know, 50, 60 mile an hour kind of speeds that they've been doing, that Cruise hasn't been doing. But again, and what's funny is that's where Tesla is going to start. Tesla is starting on highways. So they're coming at it from opposite ends of the spectrum. Very wide distribution, hundreds of thousands, millions of vehicles on the Tesla side, and the Cruise and Waymo on these sort of 100, 1,000 car deployments in very particular areas that are very highly manicured and tested and pruned. And Tesla's trying to do it everywhere all at once, moving the boiling the entire ocean simultaneously. So
yeah, Tesla sounds like it's more like they're competing with the Super Cruise team than the Cruise team.
Yeah, for right now, for sure. And also they want to keep selling incremental cars, right? So what are the features that can get people excited about buying the Tesla? Where Cruise doesn't, you know, you will not be riding in the Cruise vehicle because of the color or the shape or the comfort of the seats, really. Like it's going to be about the cost, and people will get into whatever crappy car now in Lyft or Uber to get the cheapest price. And so it's about getting from point A to point B as cheaply as possible for a lot of folks in these cities. I use that service a lot, and I will walk or use Uber if it's cheaper, or Lyft if it's cheaper. But it's very getting the vehicle is sometimes more timely than walking, so sometimes that's the problem.
Yeah, I guess the only risk for Cruise at this point is that all the major American cities could start installing reliable, efficient public transportation. So,
and that we know that
that's just not going to happen. No,
it's not. No. So, if anyone is planning to buy a Tesla
after this sales pitch,
well, you know, I'm still getting my Model 3, so I'm not I'm not down on Tesla. It's just Tesla has some work to do on their self-driving functionality. Yeah,
the Model 3 could be even more likely to be the last car that you own.
Yes, I do continue to believe that's more and more likely. If you are planning to buy a Model S or X, you can get free supercharging for life still up until the end of the year. So you've got just a couple more weeks to get that in. And if you use the referral code we include in the show notes, you will get that great free supercharging, and you will help us ensure we can go to the future Tesla events and hopefully find out more about the future of Autopilot and the Model Y and other cool vehicles and services Tesla will be releasing, and so we can bring you that info. So thanks to the Tesla geeks for providing that code to us and helping us get into these events. And if people want to get in touch with us, Mike, how can they do that?
As always, you can hit us up on Twitter at our screen name is The Tesla Show. We have a website at theteslashow.com where you can listen to all of our episodes and leave comments. And if you would like to converse, we have a subreddit on reddit.com/TheTeslaShow.
All right. Well, I hope you are fully recovered, and we haven't fully figured out our recording schedule for the final remaining weeks of the year. But
if you want to expect some outages during the holidays.
Yeah, there'll be some outages. So just follow us on Twitter. That's where we post our updates about the episodes. So if you are curious where the episodes are, check our Twitter. You'll get more details there.
All right.
All right. Talk to you later, Mike.
Bye.
Bye.